The headlines: the death toll from the recent earthquakes in Turkey and Syria rises to over 16,000 as search and rescue operations are still underway. Russia warns the UK against sending further jets to Ukraine, saying the move will have serious military and political consequences for the entire world. And North Korea displays a record number of nuclear and intercontinental ballistic missiles amid tensions with the US and South Korea. Hello and welcome, everybody. The death toll from the devastating earthquakes in Turkey and Syria has climbed to more than 16,000 as a search operation is still underway in the affected regions. According to official figures, more than 12,800 people have died in Turkey and over 3,160 have been confirmed dead in Syria. The death toll is expected to rise. A Syrian child has been pulled out alive from the rubble after 2 days. On Wednesday, a medical team found a baby alive in the Turkish province of Hatay. Another group of rescuers found four members of the same family alive under the wreckage. Rescue operations remain slow in many areas because of cold weather and a lack of necessary equipment despite the arrival of foreign teams in the two countries. Survivors in southern Turkey and northern Syria have spent a third night in the freezing cold. Our correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, gave us the latest on the situation in quake-hit northern Syria.
In the past 24 hours, just last night, an earthquake, a 4.3 magnitude earthquake, hit an area on the Syrian-Lebanese borders. The residents of Damascus and Latakia and Homs felt that earthquake, and as a result, there was a collapse for a building in an area in Harasta, in Damascus countryside over there. However, it was not a very strong earthquake, but this building collapsed because it was already fragile because of the war that happened in Syria and the battles that took place in that area. Also, latest figures, according to the Syrian government, more than 293,000 people have been displaced due to the collapses and the earthquake. According to the Minister of Education in Syria, Darim Tabba, 248 schools have been affected. The Syrian Prime Minister Hussein Arnous also toured various parts of northern Syria. He said that 267 buildings completely collapsed as a result. Now, we're speaking here about government-controlled areas. There are also dozens of buildings that collapsed in terrorist-held parts of the country, in Idlib, for example. Also, for up till now, about 180 shelter centers, temporary shelter centers, mainly schools and mosques, have been turned into shelter centers. Now, those have been established. Humanitarian assistance continues to arrive in Syria, in Damascus Airport, Latakia Airport, and Aleppo Airport.
And staying with the story, the fourth Iranian plane carrying humanitarian aid has landed at Aleppo International Airport in northwestern Syria. The latest batch of Iran's aid included tents and a variety of foodstuff. Officials say Iran will send more humanitarian supplies to Syria in the coming days. Earlier, Tehran had urged the international community to put pressure on the U.S. to lift its cruel sanctions on Syria to facilitate aid deliveries. The unlawful sanctions have hampered international efforts to assist Syrian victims of Monday's powerful quakes. Well, the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo has once again sparked outrage, this time over a cartoon mocking the catastrophic earthquakes that have recently hit Turkey and Syria.
Charlie Hebdo published a cartoon on his Twitter account showing a damaged building, a toppled car, and a heap of rubble with a caption reading, "No need to send tanks." Social media users slammed Charlie Hebdo for mocking the tragedy that has claimed the lives of thousands of people in the two countries. They described the illustration as insensitive and tasteless. Critics also argue that the cartoon dehumanizes Muslims as victims in every way. In a similar move in 2016, the magazine published a cartoon portraying the victims of a quake in Italy as pasta dishes, also sparking online anger. The cartoon showed a pile of dead bodies labeled as lasagna. The hardest hit Italian town of Amatrice is famous for producing a tomato-based pasta sauce. Back then, social media users expressed disgust at the caricature. The Italian Minister of Justice also condemned the magazine. Charlie Hebdo has been criticized for stirring up hatred under the pretext of freedom of speech and making light of tragedies in the West Asia region.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution warns the Iranian nation about the enemy's plot to bring the Islamic Republic to its knees by creating discord and mistrust within the people. Ayatollah Khamenei said the enemy has employed various tactics to pursue its strategy of driving a wedge between the Iranians. He noted that spreading lies and rumors are among these tactics. Ayatollah Khamenei also said that Iran's foes claim they are not seeking to subvert the Islamic Republic, while the conspiracies they've hatched over the years prove otherwise. The leader said the reason enemies are trying to eradicate the Islamic Republic is also rooted in the fact that Iran has cut their access to the West Asian region. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with Iranian Air Force commanders and personnel. The meeting was held on the anniversary of the historic allegiance of the Iranian Air Force with the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, in 1979, days before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Ukraine's president says France and Germany have had the opportunity, rather, to be game changers by delivering more weapons, including warplanes, to Kiev to help it fight with Russia.
The sooner we get heavy long-range weapons and our pilots get modern planes, Emmanuel, the earlier our pilots can get modern planes, Olaf, the more powerful will be our tank coalition. And I'm thankful to you for starting this path. The quicker this Russian aggression will end and we return Europe to a certain peace.
Zelensky also said that he intends to strengthen continental unity. He arrived in Paris for a dinner with French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. In a joint press conference after the meeting, Macron said Ukraine can count on France and its European partners to win the war against Russia.
European partners and its allies to win the war. Russia cannot and must not win. As long as it will attack, it will be necessary that we continue and adapt the military support vital to preserving Ukraine and its future. In the same way that we've gone ahead with new military equipment deliveries over the last few weeks, we will continue our work. Tonight we will talk together about the operational needs of Ukraine.
Macron added that Ukraine's Western allies want to lead the peace-building process alongside Kiev as an indispensable complement to the war. Meanwhile, the German chancellor said Russia must not win the war. Earlier, Zelensky visited London, where he urged the British prime minister and other Western governments to send fighter jets to Ukraine. However, Russia has warned the UK against any such move, saying it will have serious military and political consequences for the entire world. Western countries have scaled up their pledges of military aid for Ukraine. This year, they've already announced their plans to equip Kiev with hundreds of tanks and armored vehicles, as well as longer-range missiles, but have so far refused to deliver warplanes. Russia is demanding an international investigation into Nord Stream pipeline explosions after a U.S. investigation journalist alleged Washington to be behind the incidents. Chairman of the Russian State Duma, Vyacheslav Volodin, said the report should become the basis for an international probe. Volodin said the U.S. president and his accomplices should be brought to justice and that Washington should pay compensation to the affected countries. The White House has dismissed the report that showed Joe Biden had directed the attacks on the Nord Stream pipelines last September. Swedish and Danish investigators have found that the ruptures were a result of sabotage, but they have not specified who was responsible. The attacks occurred in exclusive economic zones of the two European countries. A deal recently signed by an Italian multi-utility firm and Israel's water company Mekorot has created deep concern among Italian politicians. Mekorot's role in Tel Aviv's water apartheid against Palestinians is under heavy scrutiny in Italy and several other countries. Max Civili reports from Rome.
An accord sealed in early January between the Italian multi-utility company Iren and Israel's water carrier Mekorot has triggered protests in a number of Italian cities. As a multi-utility firm, Iren, which operates solely in Italy's northern regions, provides services related to gas, electricity and water. The company's four major shareholders are the municipalities of Genoa, Turin, Parma and Reggio Emilia. On Tuesday, a council meeting held in the northwestern city of Genoa ended up in chaos, with some opposition councillors staging a protest against the Iren-Mekorot deal.
Mekorot is accused of stealing water supplies from Palestinians in the occupied territories. Through the denial of access to water and sanitation, Mekorot collaborates with the far-right cabinet of Israel in the implementation of institutionalized water apartheid, which is a central component of Israel's policies of ethnic cleansing of Palestinian communities. We believe the deal should be scrapped.
Over the past years, companies in a number of countries, including Portugal, Argentina and the Netherlands, have pulled out of deals signed with Mekorot. The decision to sever ties with Israel's water company followed protests over Mekorot's role in Tel Aviv's water apartheid against Palestinians. Israel's Mekorot provides drinking water for Israeli settlers and infrastructure for water supplies in the illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Not only Israel is accused of manipulating water supplies, but it also prohibits the construction of water networks to provide drinking water in cities and villages. Humanitarian organizations accuse Israel of violating Palestinians' rights, included in several international agreements and conventions.
Israel is stealing all the water of Palestine. Mekorot has been signing deals with many international companies across the world, and now it's Italy's turn. We denounce Israel's criminal policy of water apartheid against Palestinians and will call on Italy to respect international accords.
It is estimated that while the Palestinian population of the West Bank has doubled since the Israeli occupation formally began in 1967, water allocation for Palestinians has remained at 1997 levels. It's not just the Genoa's councillors who are calling on the municipality to scrap the Iren-Mekorot deal. Councillors from the municipalities of Reggio Emilia, Turin and Parma have demanded the governments to do the same. Max Civili, Rome.
North Korea has displayed new intercontinental ballistic missiles during a massive parade to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the founding of the country's armed forces. Images from state-run media showed the military rolling over a dozen ICBMs down the streets of Pyongyang, overseen by North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. The parade also featured tactical and long-range cruise missiles, as well as a new solid-fuel weapon which the North has long sought to develop to help make its nukes harder to detect and destroy. South Korea's foreign ministry has denounced the North's military parade, urging it to stop, quote, illegal nuclear and missile development and return to new denuclearization talks. The North has continued its missile development program despite UN resolutions and sanctions. Pyongyang describes its nuclear and missile programs as a deterrence against threats from the U.S. and some of its regional allies. The International Monetary Fund has forecasted Britain is to become the only major industrialized country to see its economy shrink in 2023. Now, a survey suggests that 7 out of 10 households fear they will be severely or moderately affected by the cost of living crisis in the first part of 2023.
A survey conducted by a leading market researcher has revealed that 72% of UK households fear they will be severely or moderately affected by the cost of living crisis in 2023, up from 54% at the end of last year. After a tough 2022, British consumers are facing an even tighter squeeze on their finances this year. Inflation is running at 10.5%, mortgage rates are rising, and the government is cutting back support on household energy bills. Meanwhile, a new report says UK households will suffer a hit to their finances of up to £4,000 in 2023, warning that the country's economy could avoid recession, but for millions it will not feel like it has. The National Institute for Economic and Social Research said the main victims of the biggest financial hit from UK's cost of living crisis are low and middle income households. That's while the British government prepares to scale back its support for energy bills this spring. The report says Britain is likely to sidestep a protracted recession this year. However, growth would remain close to zero as the impact of inflation and rising borrowing costs weigh on the country's economy. The report added at least 7 million households will be unable to meet in full their planned energy and food bills from the post-tax incomes as a result of high energy bills and the rising cost of a weekly shop. As high inflation erodes consumer spending power, the report said an average middle-income household would face a hit to their personal disposable income of 13%, reaching up to £4,000 in the next financial year. The figures come after the International Monetary Fund warned Britain was to become the only major industrialized country with a shrinking economy this year. The skyrocketing prices caused by the surging inflation have prompted many labor forces across the country to stage strikes and protests to voice their concerns about economic challenges in face of intensified cost of living crisis.
The UK has seen an economic crunch amid rampant inflation. Most public sector workers, ranging from healthcare to railways, energy, and education, have staged mass walkouts since last summer, causing widespread disruptions across the UK.
Tens of thousands of nurses and ambulance workers in the UK have staged the largest ever strike by health workers in the country, calling for pay raises in line with the country's soaring rate of inflation. Health providers have been staging separate industrial actions over the past months in a pay dispute, but the Monday stoppage was unprecedented in the 75-year history of the National Health Service in terms of scale. In front of a hospital in central London, nurses and ambulance workers of the Royal College of Nursing, the largest nursing union nationwide, waved placards and shouted slogans while encouraging passing cars to honk their support for wage increases across the medical system. The UK's Health Secretary, Steve Barclay, said he has held constructive talks with the unions while urging health workers to call off their planned strikes. However, many of the workers taking part in Monday's strike continued to highlight the huge burdens they and their colleagues are facing amid a severe cost of living crisis.
Well, I think we can already see a drop in applications to study nursing. I think we're going to find it harder and harder to recruit, harder and harder to retain staff. A lot of people have left the profession already because they're so disillusioned. I think we've got to look at the future, and that's what this is all about, actually. It's not about the present so much, it's about the future as well. So it looks like a very bleak future.
What we're protesting today is the fact that we're not paid enough and we don't really have any respect from our government. Mm. And basically we want to show people that We've worked through the whole of COVID, and we want the respect that we deserve, really. Mm. So the average income is well below the national living wage. Mm. And every month, I have colleagues having to go to food banks to feed their families.
The UK has been experiencing its longest and largest wave of strikes triggered by complicated and intertwined causes, including the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict and the government's strict austerity measures. Workers from across sectors, including healthcare, railway, and education staff, have been staging mass walkouts since last summer. They are demanding an increase in their wages in line with the double-digit inflation.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Islamic Revolution, Iranian Youth, Hope and Self-Belief. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. The Islamic Revolution triumphed with the struggles of all strata of people, especially the young generation, who were committed to their historical identity and, with hope in a bright future, fought the tyrannical regime and rescued the society via the inspiring teachings of Islam. This became a role model for other nations to get rid of suffocation and oppression. Stay tuned for more. The Islamic Revolution triumphed in Iran under the circumstances that the world was run by the Western Bloc led by the US and the Eastern Bloc led by the former Soviet Union. The two superpowers had dominated over the globe politically, economically, and militarily. Therefore, any nation which intended to free itself from the domestic despotism would cling to one of the poles of power. At that time, Iran was under a dictatorial regime which was a puppet of Washington. Thus, naturally, any movement was considered to form on the grounds of Marxism as the dominant discourse of revolutionary communities. But the Islamic Revolution gained victory by Imam Khomeini, the great religious leader who had gathered people from all walks of life around the flag of Ashura, and the instructions of Imam Hussein, the younger grandson of the Prophet of Islam. Till early 1970s, nobody believed that the Iranian people could stage an all-out uprising against the mercenary Shah under a religious leader. In fact, what caused public awakening in Iran was the revival of anti-oppression teachings of Islam. The Iranian youth found their missing identity in the justice-seeking beliefs of Islam rather than the imported thoughts like Marxism and socialism. Marxism called religion as the opium of masses, while Islam revived masses against any Western or Eastern tyrannical regime. Furthermore, the Iranian people had bitter memories of the Soviet Union in the separation of Azerbaijan from the motherland and other events in past decades and centuries. Imam Khomeini breathed the spirit of self-belief in the moribund body of the young community and inspired them against the horrific dictatorial regime which enjoyed every support of the US. Thus, they succeeded to overthrow the Shah's regime in a short time. However, 70,000 of the Iranian nation were martyred in the way of the lofty ideals of the revolution. Imam Khomeini was both the political and religious leader of the youth. Religiousness, self-belief, and hope were the three factors in the Iranian young generation which helped them topple the British-installed and American-supported Pahlavi regime. Therefore, they taught the youth in other downtrodden and oppressed countries to stand against tyranny and injustice and regain their historical ideals. The point to note here is that these three factors not only caused the Islamic Revolution triumph, but have helped it remain and flourish till this day, despite unlimited enmity of the global arrogance and Zionism. Iran has gone through innumerable conspiracies during 44 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. These conspiracies include separatist moves on borders, the 8-year imposed Iraqi war, illegal economic and political sanctions with baseless pretexts, and the round-the-clock propaganda campaign against the Iranian nation and government with the U.S., Zionist, Saudi-hired media. Nevertheless, the Iranian youths have defended the lofty ideals of the Islamic Revolution inexhaustibly. Many analysts and socio-political observers maintain that the Iranian youths will keep appearing more proudly and gloriously in the global arenas despite all hindrances put by the U.S., the Zionist regime, and their lackeys and hangers-on. The Iranian youth have already turned into the role model of freedom-seeking and justice-seeking youth across the world, and the big powers will not be able to stop this trend no matter how much they spend on their lie-disseminating media and terrorist training network here and there.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. President Joe Biden has delivered a State of the Union address to Congress, saying that the U.S. seeks competition with China rather than conflict. Biden also stated that the U.S. will cooperate with China for interests, and countermeasures will be taken if national sovereignty is threatened, such as the Chinese balloon that accidentally slipped into U.S. airspace. Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at this relationship, which China wants non-interference, while the U.S. seems to be on a war path. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who also joins us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Gilbert Doctorow, let me first start with you and see what you think about this particular statement coming at the State of the Union address of Biden, where he said, "I'm committed to work with China where we can advance American interests and benefit the world, but make no mistake, as we made it clear last week, if China threatens our sovereignty, we will act to protect our country." And we did, in reference to that balloon. What do you think of that?
Well, the words are diplomatic. The words have been very carefully chosen. However, how much depends on Mr. Biden individually in the formulation and in the deployment of U.S. foreign policy is something of a puzzle. He has, going back to November and his meeting with Xi, he has come out as in a statement-like way calling for cooperation and for a well-contained relationship with China. However, after each of these events, after each time that Biden comes out looking reasonable, there are actions by his administration which put in jeopardy all of the reasonableness that were in his words. I very much anticipate the same will be true now. What Mr. Biden says to Congress in the State of the Union message has to be seen as conciliatory for the sake of the American public. The reality is something that we'll see in the coming days and weeks.
Well, Elijah Magner, when Biden says, if China threatens our sovereignty, we will act to protect our country, and then he says, and we did, well, China, can it not say the same thing when it comes to the U.S.? I mean, if the U.S. approaches that way, then China should obviously, as an equal, do the same, right?
Potentially, yes. However, China is offering a complete different model from the U.S. The U.S. is a warmongering state that, since Second World War, is waging wars against several countries because that enriched the United States economy. However, China has not been engaged in the arms race between the Americans and the Soviet Union before the perestroika, and was building its economy. Therefore, regardless the numerous provocation that the Americans are trying to push China into, particularly in Taiwan, but not only limited to Taiwan, by pushing Japan to increase its budget for defense, by Britain going to Japan and signing a defense deal, by the Americans selling $1.5 billion worth of weapons to Taiwan, by seeing all the Americans officials visiting Taiwan, and at the same time, the level of hypocrisy of the United States administration when saying we recognize China and Taiwan are one country and Taiwan is part of China. However, they behave like Taiwan is a completely independent, it's a military base, and it's a place that is under the U.S. control. China has been waiting for the last 100 years without being provoked by the Americans, and will wait further. It doesn't mean that China is weak. On the contrary, China is watching very carefully what's happening in Ukraine, is learning a lot the style of NATO in fighting, what kind of warfare the West can wage against another country like China, because the main objective is not Russia, is to push away Russia and for the United States to dedicate all its effort toward China. And all that, the Chinese are very much aware of that and watching carefully, building their capability, military and economy, trying to be independent, creating their own semiconductor because they wanted to be independent from Taiwan, and preparing for the worst without offering a model that their option is always the war. On the contrary, they build the wall to keep away from the rest of the world and not to go and attack. They are building a prosperous economical alliance with many continents because they're saying, you become rich and we become rich with you. And they're not saying, we occupy you and we destroy you like the Americans did.
Well, that's the whole thing here. They're, the approaches, right, Gilbert, Dr. Al? I mean, I guess they're going to say it better. But the Chinese side, for example, coming from its foreign ministry spokesman, always believe that China-U.S. relations are not a zero-sum game in which you lose and I win and you rise and I fall. That's how China has categorized this relationship. But, of course, the U.S. has its own version, like what the president said when it comes to competition. The U.S. seeks competition with China rather than conflict. That's kind of hard to believe when you take a look at Taiwan, isn't it? When it's pumping military supplies there, when it fuels separatist aspirations and sends high-ranking U.S. officials to that island.
Well, I would like to add remarks that fill out a bit what my fellow panelists have said. China is not a country of bunny rabbits. Unlike Russia, which has been for the most part under the last 20 years of Mr. Putin, reactive to Western pressures and Western aggressive actions, in terms of expansion of NATO. China has been proactive and has been an initiator of efforts to further its own domestic security at the expense of the United States. By pushing out into the South China Sea, by constructing these artificial islands that have a defense purpose, China is clearly intent on removing American presence in its immediate neighborhood. That is not an aggressive position, but it is a clearly defined defensive position that comes at the expense of the United States. And in light of that, American behavior has to be interpreted as in part responding to the Chinese efforts. In this way, when I speak of it in this way, we have a situation that is very different from NATO expansion up to the borders of Russia. Here it is Chinese expansion in terms of its building its navy to the largest in the world, and it's building support for the navy in these artificial islands. They are proactively extending their military strength in their neighborhood.
Do you agree with our guest there, Elijah Magner, because in a sense it's a reaction to some of your statements that you made prior?
Well, it's very nicely put. However, China is not building military bases around the United States. The United States has increased the building of more military bases in the Philippines, adding four more, and then it has a dozen more of bases in different countries. This is not what China is doing. China made a deal with the Solomon Island that is 9,000 miles away from the United States, and the United States considered that as an attack against its sovereignty, and it's a threat to the national security. We're talking about 9,000 miles a deal between the Solomon Island and China. When we see in Ukraine with the Russian, and we're not justifying the Russian occupation here, it's saying that Ukraine represents a security, national security danger. So by China building its navy and its military, well done, because it is threatened by the United States that is going to the China Sea. The NATO is a North Atlantic Treaty Organization that's supposed not to be to put its nose in the China Sea, is going to talk to Korea, is talking to Japan, and is trying to collaborate with them. NATO is a military apparatus made for 30 nations under the U.S. Control and command. What NATO is doing in China, around China?
Gilbert Doctorow.
Well, so far, this is jawboning. It is... you have in mind clearly Mr. Stoltenberg's visit to Korea. The United States is trying to find support in the neighboring countries of China for its containment policy. Its success in this regard has been mixed. And to liken this to NATO, that is something that Washington would welcome as a concept, but it is not the case in fact. The Southeast Asian countries, led by Indonesia, have been resistant to America's calls to actively engage in containment against China. The case of the Philippines is a special one. It has its own special history and contested issues with China. And the Philippines has gone this way and that way over the last 20 years, with respect to its closeness or remoteness from the United States and United States policies. As to Japan and Korea, this is not a shut case. The United States has a lot of work to do if it is to formulate an alliance that has any effect in containing China. The NATO is completely subservient to the United States. Europe is subservient to the United States in a way that the Asian countries so far have resisted.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, since we're talking about NATO, what is the deal with an Asian NATO? If you can tell us, Elijah Magnier, because it was in June that NATO actually had a summit, and for the first time it included the countries, which I'm reading here, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. Of course, then it fueled speculation that there's going to be a NATO, Asian NATO. Why does NATO feel it has to expand all over the world and unite countries? And in this case, obviously, it would be against China.
Well, the rule is very simple. The United States doesn't prefer to go to war alone. The American administration needs always allies to be with it, to go to war with it. This is what the Americans have done in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Iraq, in Syria. NATO is there, it's everywhere. Why? Because the United States is saying, well, we're not alone. However, the West represents only between 14 to 16% of the world population. Nonetheless, they are made of warmongering states who follow the U.S. policy blindly and who walk along with what the U.S. objectives are. So when NATO is moving around, NATO is not an independent organization. NATO is made of 30 nations led by the U.S. The commander is an American, and the biggest budget is offered by the Americans. So when the NATO is moving, it means that the Americans is telling those who are concerned that we are not alone against you, but we will have a coalition of different nations.
Okay. If you have a reaction to our guest there, Elijah Magnier, Gilbert Doctorow, go ahead. If not, I'm going to move to another issue when it comes to China and the U.S. Do you have a reaction to Elijah Magnier?
No, I have no difficulty with what he's just said.
Okay, so let's move to one of the things that stands out when it comes to this relationship. And this, I believe, was really something that was put out there strongly, and I'm going to come from the U.S. side, from Anthony Blinken. This is going back a few months. Calling China the most serious long-term threat to the world order. Beijing's vision would move us away from the universal values that have sustained so much of the world's progress. And I'm just going to stop there, where you have the U.S. obviously having that particular view, but yet China doesn't feel that way. What is the deal with the way that the U.S. thinks about China in those in that scene or in that context?
I would change the language a little bit to other terms that Blinken and State Department people have been using from time to time. And that word is revisionist. Both Russia and China have been categorized by the State Department, by the United States administration, as being revisionist states. What exactly does that mean? I think that is a more accurate description of the global situation than what you just were mentioning 2 minutes ago, that these countries do not respect the values and are challenging the principles that underlie world order. It is more precise. It is to speak about the alignment of the world's nations at the board of directors table. And that is where the revisionism comes in. It is truly accurate that these two countries, in particular China and Russia, are leading the pack. India is also a very active participant in the call for revising the seating order at the table of governors of the world. in China and Russia are the leaders, but there are a number of other countries that are followers, and all of this is seen to be aimed at undermining and overturning the United States global hegemony.
And to just finish this particular topic off, Elijah Magnier, you have a U.S. senator that says we have different visions for whether the world should be safer for democracy or authoritarianism. When you have a U.S. senator say that, where this particular senator said the world of Chinese President Xi Jinping's vision would be unacceptable, why does the U.S. think that their way is the way that has to move forward and not any others, especially China's?
The problem is the Chinese, the Russian, the North Korean never claimed to be democratic countries. However, we in the West claim to have democracy. Nonetheless, we have a letter received by a U.S. Secretary of State, Tillerson, Rex Tillerson, telling him that we use human rights only against our enemy, but not against our friend who are dictators. Therefore, we have a double standard when they are clearly saying, this is our regime, this is how we rule, this is how we control our country, and you deal with us. This is what, like the Americans are dealing with countries like Saudi Arabia, like Egypt, like Jordan, like so many other countries considered friend of the U.S. And here I don't use the world order or the international order, because there isn't a world order. There is a Western order. There is a Western value and Western understanding of how things to be done. And the reason why China is a serious threat, look what's happening today. China has its own strong currency. It has reserved in gold, huge reserve in gold, when the U.S. is indebted to $31.4 trillion. It has an Asian bank with $100 billion capital. It is building the Silk Road, connecting Asia, Europe, and Africa. All these plans represent a serious danger to, as Yoget said, the U.S. hegemony.
Well, an interesting piece of stat came out, and it's not very recent, but it came out just recently, Gilbert Doctorow, which points to whether the U.S. is actually ready to go down the route that it is. I mean, I'm not too sure what goes on in terms of, obviously, the way that they've mapped out their approach to China. But when you look at goods that were traded between the U.S. and China for 2022, it's hit a record high. What are we looking at? The $690.5 billion for the year 2022. How can the U.S. even think, then, from decoupling from China in one way or another, when it's, and asking other countries to do so, when it's having record trade happen between it and China?
Well, you're pointing to the logical disconnect in the policies of the American foreign establishment. The President Putin, remarking on America's simultaneously trying to contain Russia and China, and thereby pushing them into one another's arms, the United States is pursuing what Putin called an insane policy. And I think that, regrettably, that characterization holds true. The United States cannot possibly decouple from China and still have store shelves filled with products for the American consumers to buy. This is a long-term process, but the United States is concentrating on several very sensitive areas, and beginning with semiconductors, to contain China's growth and prevent its further expansion as a global power at the expense of America's position. So the decoupling is being handled with great care, since, as I said, if it were to be done to the full extent, the United States stores would all be bare of products. But this is directional, what is going on, and the intention is that over time, the Chinese role in global trade will be diminished. Will they succeed? It is anyone's guess. China, for its own part, is now directing a great deal of effort to develop the consumer side of its own economy and to become less reliant on export earnings.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to expand more on that chip issue because that is a huge one, but because of lack of time, the question now to you, Elijah Magnier, is about the U.S. warning to China. We shot off one when it came to Russia, confronting China over companies that have ties to Russia, because according to the way the U.S. sees it, there's evidence of non-lethal aid, as it has called it, going to Russia. At the same time, we're looking at Russia-China ties to be solid as ever. Where do you see that going? Because we know how the U.S. can react when it comes to Russia and China in any form assisting it.
Russia is a country that can declare war. We've seen Russia in Ukraine, before that in Georgia, in Moldova, in different places where the Russians have the courage or the intention to go and declare war on other states. However, China has not been doing so since decades. And because the Chinese did not declare war against countries that fall within the U.S. satellite, the problem with China, between China and the U.S., is it is important for the U.S. to separate China from Russia. The more threat China feels from the U.S., the closer Chinese are going to go toward Russia, because they're learning from this war. They are seeing what the Americans and NATO are using, what kind of weapons and tactic are using in this war, what kind of sanctions they are imposing on Russia, how far they can go, how they can damage infrastructure, how they can really damage themselves in order to damage Russia, like cutting the gas, mainstream one and two. So all that is a very rich learning ground for the Chinese. And the way China is standing next to Russia is, as long as Russia is at war with the U.S., the U.S. will be busy away from China, which is a very clever way to do it. However, the Chinese feed the threat coming from the Americans in Taiwan and all the bases around it, because they feed that the Americans perhaps need another war after Russia, and perhaps Russia will stop after taking the four provinces and will create kind of Korea, north and south, no peace, no war, and then the Americans can dedicate more effort to China.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, and Gilbert Doctorow, thank you. Independent international affairs analyst, both from Brussels. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyya for Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn Zainul Abidin. We go to the part where the Imam alayhi salam seek refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from number of sins. And we go to the part where he says, وَاسْتِزْغَارُ الْمَعْصِيَةِ وَاسْتِكْثَارُ الطَّاعَةِ. Belittling sins and thinking that you've done too much when it comes to obedience. So we little the sins. We say, oh, I didn't do much. When it comes to me doing obedience to Allah, I do a small thing to Allah, and then I think it is big. So first, let us look at belittling sins. We as human beings, we are not infallible. That's a statement we always make. We make sins because we are not infallible. We are not prophets, and we are not imams. So we make sins. The fact is, when it comes to sins, we seem to classify sins in our own way. So I seem to think that there are sins which are okay, small sins. And I seem that there are sins that are big. So I give myself the right to indulge in the smaller ones and refrain from the big ones. So we might look at lying and backbiting and gossiping as a small sin. I don't do much. I'm just talking. And the person says, well, but I'm not drinking alcohol, I'm not killing a human being, I'm not committing fornication or adultery, so these are major sins. Then it is we who decides what's sin and what's not, what's big and what's not. That precisely itself, this classification, is a problem. Let us take a short break and then we'll come back.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge. So you are saying that it is a big problem for a person to come along and belittle sins. Now, what we always have to keep in mind is that when it comes to any sin, at the end of the day, it is a sin. And when it is a sin, it means you